Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a conversation with pediatrician T. Barry Brazelton. But first, one of Lebanon's best-known and most outspoken journalists was killed today when he turned the ignition key in his car and a bomb planted under his seat exploded. Samir Kassir was a columnist for the leading daily Al-Nahar. He was known for writing harsh criticisms of the Syrian regime that has dominated politics in Lebanon. Rula Beydoun was a colleague of Kassir's, a reporter for Al-Nahar. She joins us on the line. And Rula, first, our sympathies for your loss. What was your reaction when you learned Kassir had been killed?
I was totally shocked, and I was... it was horrible because I did not expect it at all. And a few hours before... yesterday we were speaking together and analyzing things, and suddenly when I heard this news this morning, it was horrible, and I cried like for some time now. And you know, he's one of us, one of our guys, and he was killed. It's something that touches you directly and personally. It's not like it's somebody far away. He's one of us, you know.
Well, one of us, you say, but also above many younger journalists looked up to him, we hear.
Yes, because he was a very daring and very courageous journalist who used to say things many people believed and did not say as clearly as he did.
Like what?
And as you mentioned, regarding the security services and the Syrians, and even the Syrian regime in Syria, he used to say things in a very frank way, even before others. Now many people tend to speak, but before, he was one of the pioneers, if we can call him like this.
Well, his death comes a few months after the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, which led, as you well know, to protests, which led to Syria being forced to finally withdraw its troops from Lebanon. And his death also comes in the middle of rolling elections in which Hariri's son is said to be doing very well in Beirut districts.
Yes.
So what is your sense? Why was Kassir killed? Did it have anything to do with the assassination of Rafiq Hariri?
Many people here believe that the assassination is linked to his former criticisms of and the ones he continued also of the security services and of the Syrians. And many people believe that this shows that the security services are still here and are still quite active.
The Syrian security services. But of course,
both, the Syrian and the Lebanese, both.
One of the political leaders in Lebanon today is blaming the current president of Lebanon, Lahoud, for the death of Samir Kassir. Can you explain what some of the other political machinations might be?
Many of the parties in the opposition believe that Lahoud is only a cover for the services here. He is accused of being the head of the services, actually. And some had asked for his departure already 2 months ago. But this did not happen because there were other things happening. And now today you hear again this demand for the departure of the President of the Republic, who is considered by many as being the head of the services. Mm-hmm. And I think many accusations go in this direction today here in Lebanon.
What does this say about the status of Lebanon?
It says that we have not gotten out of the troubles yet, and that a lot is still to be accomplished. And you know, the opposition had shown a lot of unity and had accomplished many things. And then there were some problems in the opposition itself since the return of General Aoun from France, because instead of the opposition growing larger, it looks a bit divided today. But today there is a meeting in 2 hours of the opposition, and we hope that this will put things back on the right track as they were before 1 month, before the return of General Aoun.
In other words, you're saying that perhaps the death of Samir Kassir might unify the opposition again.
This is what many hope here as the only positive thing that can come out of this horrible, very, very horrible thing that happened today.
Rula Beydoun is a reporter for Al-Nahar newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon, also a colleague of Samir Kassir, who was killed today by a car bomb. Rula, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
I've always traded pediatrics for art.
We recently visited the Cambridge, Massachusetts home of T. Barry Brazelton, perhaps the country's most popular pediatrician, and author of a series of new books based on his theory of touch points, the thinking that children regress a little in order to make a developmental leap forward. Each book addresses a different touch point, feeding, toilet training, and the newest, sibling rivalry and managing your anger. Dr. Brazelton and his co-author, Dr. Joshua Sparrow, maintain that most anger and aggression in children is as bewildering to them as it is to their parents.
I think that's what it is, you know, that they're out of control and they know it, and it scares them.
It could be you give one example of a little boy might be in an entranceway to a room, he just doesn't know which direction to go in, and he can fall apart.
And that's exactly what they do. They're really trying to come to the point of being in control themselves rather than taking it from us. And so if parents can see that as a big step in their emotional development and their cognitive development and their motor development, then it isn't such a threat anymore.
You have a lot of ways that parents can deal with children's anger and aggression, starting with, you know, swaddling an infant so that it's a flailing arm doesn't frighten the infant. Mm-hmm. But on up to the older children, and I want to run through some of those because, you know, parents might be hearing you and hearing a laughter in your voice and saying, but I'm desperate when this happens. What happens when it's older children and a child is out of control in a tantrum?
Well, you know that terrible thing that happened in Florida, the child being handcuffed mm-hmm. for having an aggression, a period of out of control. That five-year-old was crying for help, and somebody should have been ready to listen. I don't know the circumstances, so I don't want to take that. But we wrote an article. We write for the New York Times Syndicate, and we wrote an article, and we named it "Don't Leave Any Handcuffed Child Behind."
but let's take that case. I was going to ask you about it because the teachers there said they had tried everything, and this child was disrupting the class, and the one teacher had taken her aside, and you could see in the videotape was sort of gently slapping her hands down. But you say there's a physical way even to approach a child who is in this case. What are some of the things a parent can do?
Well, you can just pick up a child 5 and hold it tight. And if it's going to bang her head or kick you or whatever, you know, you can get a hold on them that keeps them from hurting you.
You suggest sitting a child in your lap facing away from you mm-hmm. with your arms around their front and then maybe gently putting a leg over their legs if
their
you need
legs.
To.
And safety is the first step. And then when you've got them safe, say, now calm down, calm down, calm down, and don't get excited because that just adds to their excitement. Once they've calmed down, say, now let's talk about it. What was it? And then listen. And once you listen, then you have some idea of what triggered this, and you can begin to try to explain it to the child who wants to know themselves, and you can explain it to yourself. And then at the end of it, say, every time you do this, I'll have to control you until you can control yourself. And that's the acme. That's when you've really made it, when they can control themselves.
What do you do if you suspect, you know,
it's more serious? Yeah, I think when the parent feels they're out of control too and they don't know what to do about that child, it's time to turn to somebody else. And it doesn't need to be a psychiatrist. It can be somebody who can put their finger on what's behind it. But I don't think you can just throw a child away when they're in trouble like that. I think the main thing is your own, as a parent, your own feelings.
In fact, you write about ghosts from the nursery, that many times it may not be the child that needs the help. The child's reflecting a serious problem in the parent.
Yeah, I think every child calls up the ghosts from your own nursery, and when they hit on something that's very sensitive, you know, you don't have a lot of control over that. One of my grandchildren said to his mother, who's a lot like me, Mommy, he was 6 at this point, Mommy, we'll do better when you calm down. You know, he was right on target because once she calmed down, this made her laugh, and then she calmed down and things went just swimmingly.
What else might, though, be reflected? I mean, give me some more examples of when a parent might pull themselves up short and say, wait a minute, this child is triggering something in me.
Well, I went to the grocery store the other day, and this woman was whamming away at her two-year-old, you know, banging on him because he pulled things off the shelf. So I went over, and so I said to her, "Isn't it awful to bring a two-year-old to the grocery store?" And she sat down and started weeping and wept. And at that point, this two-year-old climbed up in her lap and patted her face. And so I said to her, "You know, this really gets to you, doesn't it?" And she said, "Oh, my mother used to just tie me up in knots when she'd go to the grocery store, because if she didn't tie me up, I'd be pulling everything off." I said, "You realize what you're bringing from your own past?" And she said, "I never thought of it before."
You know, I'm also thinking it must have been, this woman looks up and there's T. Barry Brazelton telling her what to do with her child. But so what does that mother do now?
Well, I think there are a lot of things she could do. One is not bring the child to the grocery store. But the other is, if she does, put him in the cart. You know, the grocery stores have figured this out. You put him in the cart and keep him there. And the third thing is that if it isn't working, gather that child up in your arms and take him out to the car and sit there with him. Say, "Now, when you're ready, we'll go back. But until you can get ready, we can't be there."
How do you navigate, well, even as a pediatrician, when you can see that a child may be acting out or angry, and then there's a real problem with the parent, alcoholism or something that a parent is not likely to see?
I think when the child is sad, when they don't respond with excitement about learning something new, then you look behind that and trying to help these people, not criticizing them, but saying, "Look, things aren't going right, are they? Can't I help?" And then listen. And people are willing to tell you.
I just want to, before we get off the topic, go through some more things on your list of how to help a child settle angry feelings. You talk about a mother who might throw glasses. Another suggestion, mashing a ball of clay, pounding on paper with crayons, drawing angry monsters, building tall buildings or block towers and knocking them down. I mean, letting the child have those feelings in a safe way.
Sure, because at 4 and 5, aggression and realizing it is a very important developmental process. And a child who begins to feel aggressive and doesn't know what to do with these feelings begins to have monsters under the bed, witches in the closet. That's a sign that this child is trying to learn how to manage his own aggressive feelings. And one of the best ways is to point out your own losses of control. You know, say to him, "You know, I could have hit that lady. She made me so mad, but I didn't." And then the child can learn something from you.
We're getting free advice today from pediatrician T. Barry Brazelton. Another tip: when an older child loses it, tell him to take a shower. When we come back, Brazelton on sibling rivalry and what to do if you think you favor one child over another. Stay with us. More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're spending some time today with pediatrician T. Barry Brazelton. His latest round of the Brazelton Way handbooks for parents include Mastering Anger and Aggression and Understanding Sibling Rivalry. At a visit with the famed doctor at his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I asked, what's the biggest mistake parents make when dealing with sibling rivalry?
Trying to make them love each other, because it doesn't work if they stay out of it and let sibling rivalry be one side of the coin and learning to care about each other be the other side of the coin, they learn to love each other.
In practicing this with nephews and nieces, have tried to adopt your theory. I've actually used the exact words where I've said to them, "You know, I respect you. You are great kids, and I know you can work this out." How long do you wait to see if they can?
Well, I was 50 before I liked my brother. So I can't promise any cutoff point. But, you know, you watch them together and you can see if there is an adult standing nearby, you can see that they're really trying things out with each other and looking to see how the other one's reacting. And you can watch them behaviorally and see that they're learning a lot from each other.
What do you do if you have one child who really shuts down and
becomes the victim, and the other child who sort of smells that blood, and she's much more aggressive and takes advantage of that.
I would work individually, not in front of each other, and talk to the victim, try to shore them up so they weren't so passive about it, because this certainly happens. It's something we certainly see in schools with bullying and teasing and all of that, that kids that are too passive have almost set up patterns of being a victim, and everybody knows it. So those kids really need a chance to be pulled out, given some strengths and so forth. Pull them aside and say, you know, you can fight back. Maybe you're afraid to. Maybe you think mommy doesn't want you to or something. And I don't want you all to fight, but I don't want you to be a victim either.
So you can encourage them to stand up for themselves.
Yeah, sure.
Well, you also raise in your book, Understanding Sibling Rivalry, the thing parents don't like to talk about. What if the kids are reflecting a parent's feeling and the parent honestly has to confront the feeling maybe they do like a child better than another child?
Well,
By the way, I don't want any children listening at this point.
You're wonderful. I think confronting those feelings makes them not so strong. The second you have a bias, if you bring it to the surface, it doesn't operate any longer. You have a choice. And so if you can confront the fact that you really do feel more comfortable with this child right now, because it's right now, it changes from time to time, then you aren't as likely to act on it. Children know. They know very well when you have favorites or don't have favorites. My three girls spent their lives competing, which in a way taught them a great deal, but in the other way, they were really hard on me whenever they could be.
I was going to ask, were you a good dad?
Yeah, I was. I was real good when they were little. When they got to be adolescents, I was scared to death, so I wasn't much good. I'm still an adolescent.
Well, that's encouraging for parents to hear. They're not the only ones. If you made one mistake, what do you think it was as a father?
Well, I think being as ambitious as I was and being so involved in all of my work and the excitement of it and all, competed with their feeling that did I care as much about them? And maybe I didn't overtly express it as much as I wish I had now, because it wasn't competitive, it was additive. But they didn't know it. When I'd go to the school where they went, all of my patients would climb up in my lap, and I'd see my own child over in the corner sucking her thumb. And I'd say, oh, my gosh, this is terrible. So I'd dump the kids off my lap and go grab her. But, you know, it was already too late. She already felt shoved out by these other kids.
Do you address that in the way that...
I do now. I talk to them. My son's a pediatrician out in Wisconsin, and so we were interviewed by the newspaper out there when I was out there, and they said to him, what was it like to have a father who was famous at the time you were growing up? And he said, awful. And I said, Tom, you wouldn't have gone through medical school without owing all this money. You wouldn't have had this. You wouldn't have had that. And he said, yeah, but I would have had more of you. And I said, well, what do you mean more? Because you had me all the time until you were about 12 when I finally hit the fan. And he said, oh, was it that long? So you see, they distort everything anyway. There's no way you can really be sure.
And there's no way you can win.
No, you can't win as a parent. Don't try too hard.
Well, it sounds like you're saying that you've sacrificed, you know, some sort of connection with your own children because of what you've given to other children. So given that, What do you want that legacy to be, you know, even, you know, given especially that you made some sacrifices for it?
I guess I really want to see parents and children as our first priority in this country, and they're probably our bottom priority at present. It's just so discouraging to see what we're doing to children, you know, testing 4-year-olds. It's just absurd. And I think things have just gone so crazy in the past few years that it scares me.
T. Barry Brazelton, do you mind asking how old you are?
87.
You just look so great. Do you think, and you go to work, do you think that because you handle babies so much, you are younger?
Sure I do, yeah. My grandchildren say, Papa, you're the oldest two-year-old we've ever known. I think they're right.
Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, Robin, I love working with you. You're just terrific.
Feelings Mutual, pediatrician T. Barry Brazelton. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll continue taking notes. Tomorrow, the editor of the New York Times Book Review will have a summer reading list. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. By tomorrow, the fate of pop star Michael Jackson could be in the hands of the jury. Jackson is charged with one count of conspiracy to commit child abduction, four counts of child molestation, one count of attempted molestation, false imprisonment and extortion, and four counts of giving a minor alcohol while committing a felony. Jackson's accuser is a 15-year-old boy, a cancer survivor who was 13 at the time of the alleged abuse. Jackson's attorneys have focused much of their attention during the trial on the boy's family. Tina Sussman is covering the Jackson trial for New York's Newsday. We spoke just before today's closing arguments got underway, and I asked her how the two sides might summarize their case for the jury.
Well, the first up is going to be the prosecution, and they are basically expected to really hammer away at the point that they've been trying to get across, namely that this family was the victim of a wild conspiracy by Michael Jackson and several of his associates to hold them captive with the aim of forcing them to make a complimentary video, essentially one that would rebut this infamous 2003 documentary, Living with Michael Jackson, in which Michael Jackson was shown kind of nuzzling a young boy and announcing to the world that he enjoyed sharing his bed with children.
Mm-hmm.
According to the prosecutors, the family was held captive, forced to make a rebuttal video, which never aired, actually, and that the molestation is alleged to have occurred during that time of captivity in February and March of 2003. The defense is expected to once again hammer away at their point that the family is a bunch of grifters who have a habit of latching on to the rich and famous in the Hollywood and sports world and trying to shake them down for money. They have essentially focused their case from the beginning on putting the accusers on trial, not just the boy, but especially his mother, who has really been the loosest cannon and a lot of loose cannons on the witness stand here.
But by the way, we should point out, you are at the courthouse right now, and there are a lot of people there, and we can hear them, including fans of Michael Jackson who've been coming every day for the trial. Well, we want to ask you quickly about the testimony part of the trial, which concluded Friday with the police interview tape that the prosecution presented of the alleged victim in which he is speaking to the police at the age of 13, telling his side of the story. Can you tell us briefly about the tape, and how did people in the courtroom react to it?
The tape was considered a real turning point in this trial. It was hard to say how people were reacting while the tape was going on. The courtroom was very dark. I was sitting very close to the jury and really trying to gauge their reaction. One thing I can tell you is that the courtroom was extraordinarily hushed when that tape was going on. The jurors have been told that they are only allowed to consider that tape for the demeanor of the child, not for the truth or non-truth of what the child says.
Hmm.
The point being that the defense says that this tape would prove its point that this boy was coached, that these charges were trumped up, that he had been rehearsed over and over and over again by his mother to say the right things to the police. The prosecution wanted to show this tape to prove that the boy was not coached, that he was acting like any normal, embarrassed, awkward 13-year-old boy would act when asked to describe, you know, acts of sex with a man far older than he. The legal analysts here all agree that tape really could be a turning point in the trial, simply because I think even to a casual observer, you'd have to say the boy does not appear coached. He comes across as a pretty normal, rather sullen 13-year-old boy who is being coaxed to discuss something that he finds very embarrassing and uncomfortable and forced to admit something that he really doesn't want to admit to the world. Hmm. The biggest surprise about the video is that the defense did not rebut it. The defense had been expected to actually call the boy back up to the stand to grill him and try once again to undercut whatever progress the prosecution made by showing that video. They didn't, and that really remains one of the biggest questions of this trial, is why they didn't.
Tina Sussman is covering the Michael Jackson trial for New York's Newsday. She spoke to us from the courthouse in Santa Maria, California. Tina, thanks very much.
All right. Thank you so much.
Well, first there was .com, then .org. Soon there may be .xxx. Creating a .xxx domain name is currently a proposal before the group that oversees Internet domains. It's an idea that some members of the adult entertainment industry support in order to help parents block children from accessing adult sites. Well, on the line to talk about it is John Palfrey, Executive Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. John, there are supporters of this idea, but objections as well. What would they be?
The objections are twofold primarily. One is that some people think you shouldn't categorize sites in such a fashion as to give a sense of them being positive or negative. And I guess I don't credit that objection much, but I think there are lots of people who do put it out there. Secondly, there are people who suggest that it's an absurd idea to think that you can put adult content into one segment of the web and expect it to stay there.
Well, and expect everyone to jump into it. I'm assuming that some of the sites, for instance, pedophiles who might run an adult entertainment site, are not going to want to make themselves known.
Sure, I think that's exactly right, that the people who will opt into the system are ones that are not the worst offenders, in a sense.
Well, how regulated is the adult entertainment industry online anyway?
It's very unregulated as an overall rule. One of the things about the Internet, of course, is that it's international, and so a lot of things that go on offshore are hard to enforce in terms of catching people who are doing something wrong. But also, generally, the Internet is not a particularly regulated space in terms of content, and that's certainly true if you're thinking about it from an American perspective, where the First Amendment is very strong. The only counterexample to this is child pornography, which is a very strong focus of law enforcement.
Right. Well, a British businessman who runs a company called ICM Registry is the one applying to create this .xxx domain name and registry. What's in it for him if it's approved?
When you get to have more namespace in the web, you can charge people to register their names there. So if somebody were the registrar for .xxx and somebody creates a new porn site, you have a lot of control in being able to charge them in order to register their sites into that domain. It's a very lucrative, high-margin business.
Yeah. Well, and finally, the National Academy of Sciences, in a recent report, cautioned that perhaps corporate interests have too much influence in the Internet naming process. I mean, otherwise, they said it was going pretty well, but that was a concern. Your thoughts?
The body that oversees the naming business, ICANN, is a problematic organization from the perspective that it's really a nonprofit corporation, which is often considered to be captured by corporate interests. And I think there's some truth to that assertion. But I think it also stems back to how we've thought about the Internet overall, which is that the private sector should lead the way in terms of regulation. And I'm not sure that over time this can't work out in a good way, that the industry can't regulate itself. But as of right now, it's certainly true that corporations have a huge amount of control over what happens on the Internet.
John Palfrey is Executive Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. John, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And still to come, Steve Allman, the author of Candy Freak, is known for having a soft spot for the sweet stuff, but he tackles the often bitter side of love in his new collection of short stories. He's coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. With the onset of summer, police across the country are getting ready to deal with a potentially deadly pastime for young people, drag racing.
114 people were killed in drag racing accidents in 2003, the most recent year that statistics are available. But that figure has jumped by about 50% since 1998. Across the country, lawmakers are looking for new ways to prevent drag races. In Florida, the legislature last month approved a bill that would send repeat offenders to jail for up to a year and confiscate their cars. In Los Angeles, police are visiting schools and universities to talk about the dangers of drag racing. And Gastonia, North Carolina, about 20 miles west of Charlotte, is also working on a plan. Last week, police say a drag racer lost control of his car and hit five pedestrians. Well, joining us on the line is Sergeant D.D. Reinhardt of the Gastonia Police Department. Sergeant Reinhardt, welcome. And can you tell us what happened in that accident last week?
We had a Hispanic male who was racing a white female, and we really don't know what caused him to lose control of the vehicle. He was on a pretty straight stretch of road. He ran off the road to the right about a block away from the Dairy Queen where the accident happened and struck a telephone pole. And then about a block later, he came off the road again and struck another telephone pole and hit five people who were standing in line at the ice cream shop.
And we want to be clear, none of those people were killed.
No.
No, but still. So this is, you know, sort of marauding through town. Describe Gastonia for us and tell us, how often do these drag races take place?
Gastonia is a urban community. It has about 65,000 people. Gastonia has a long tradition and history of about 50 years of being the place where teenagers come to hang out. Mm-hmm. People tell us that drag racing does take place pretty normally, but from what we see, the limited amount of time that we can actually spend on Franklin Boulevard, we don't see it every night, but I'm sure, you know, from red light to red light, it does happen pretty frequently.
Well, and I know that you're, as a town, trying to come up with a plan to thwart it, because even there were no fatalities in that accident, but I understand that there has been, you know, terrible violence as a result of this drag racing.
Right, and actually about 15 years ago, we did have a drag racing accident that turned out to be deadly, and that stays fresh in your mind, though, although that happened that long ago. I mean, you know, I can still remember it happened and remember the impact that it had on Gastonia.
Well, you know, I was going to mention, in 2003 and 2001, there were two movies on drag racing, The Fast and the Furious and then Too Fast, Too Furious. There were deaths as a result of drag racing across the country, and many police departments attributed it to young people imitating the Vin Diesel movie. Do you see a rise in this in your town?
We had a community forum just last Friday night with some teenagers. That movie was brought up by the kids who happened to mention it. Since they saw that movie, they wanted to imitate that.
Well, what, as a police department, are you going to do?
We started what we're calling the Franklin Boulevard Project. We have people as old as 35 years old who like to cruise Franklin Boulevard. We actually are trying to get them cleared out of the private property parking lot. We had a community forum with the teenagers and getting their input as to what positive alternatives they would like to see, and then we're probably going to start a big enforcement project.
Sounds as if the age-old problem of, you know, finding other things for young people to do. And that brings up the thought, Sergeant. I can just hear people saying, well, the kids have always drag raced, and they've always imitated movies, whether it was Rebel Without a Cause or Too Fast, Too Furious. I just wonder, from your perspective, what would you want to say to people about your fears about what could happen to kids?
I've been a police officer for 20 years, and not too long after the wreck I mentioned earlier, 15 years ago, where a drag racing incident caused a fatality, about a year later we had another wreck where two children that were 18 and 19 years old were killed in a high-speed accident on the other end of Franklin Boulevard. They were rumored to have been racing, but we never could prove that, but they ran across the median and hit a tractor-trailer truck head-on, killing both of them instantly. When you're a police officer and you're standing out in the middle of the road and you have two kids and, you know, their parents are at home and they think everything, their world's perfect right then. They think everything's perfect and they don't know that in about an hour their whole world's going to shatter. And I guess that from a police point of view, that's what I look at. It happens very rarely, but you never know who it's going to happen to. The different things that can happen, not just drag racing but cruising. I mean, we've had murders that have occurred on Franklin Boulevard because teenagers and young adults have gotten mad at each other and went and did some kind of retaliation. It's just very important for parents to get involved with their kids and try to find something positive for them to do, because they don't want that knock on the door that's going to come and tell them that their world's never going to be the same again.
Sergeant D.D. Reinhardt of Gastonia, North Carolina. Sergeant, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Speculation about Michael Jackson's legal problems, or Abraham Lincoln's sexuality, or wondering, how must a child feel if he kills another child with a baseball bat? All of these thoughts were in author Steve Almond's head before they were in the headlines, and now they're gathered as short stories in his new collection, The Evil B.B. Chow. Here he reads from the title story, narrated by a woman on a second date with an overeager suitor with a mysterious name, B.B. Chow.
I know I should be scooting along. I've got my own rounds to make. The event schedule I keep overbooked to stamp out any late weekend embers of anguish. And here's this guy who's obviously, at the very least, neurotic. At the same time, I'm touched by his candor, his overwrought confessions. It's the first day of spring, and the streets finally smell again. Everywhere the righteous folk of Cambridge are strolling the Polony avenues, letting the breeze sift their hair. Students are draped across one another, unbearably young, auditioning for sex in chunky shoes. "B.B.," I say, taking his arm, "I like you."
That's Steve Almond reading from his new collection, The Evil B.B. Chow and Other Stories. And Steve joins us in the studio. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
We should point out a hometown favorite. You're also here now, sometime literary correspondent. Your new book follows on the heels of the wildly popular Candy Freak, about your love of candy. And you also teach creative writing at Boston College. So with that last thing in mind, how do you know when a short story is really a short story and when it's not just an author being lazy, not deciding to take it into a novel?
You know, my superego asks me that question every day. Well, am I just being lazy? Why don't I spend more time with this character? Why can't I commit to these characters? And, you know, the answer is, I know when a short story is done, but I don't know. Maybe it should be the beginning of a novel and I just have commitment issues.
Well, speaking of which, one of your favorite subjects is sprinkled liberally throughout these short stories is sex. You write very graphically about sex. You write about body fluids and bad breath and sex. What is it about sex?
What isn't it? The reason that I have a lot of sex in my stories, that is where the characters are laid bare, and that is where all the ecstatic, embarrassing stuff about them,
right,
like what their bodies do and how their breath smells, you know, that is an emotionally dangerous place. The way
because it's not, we should say, it's not romanticized sex.
No. This would not be get you in the mood kind of sex.
Right.
It's much more as it exists in the real world. It's very awkward. It's very embarrassing. It's terribly exciting, but it's very scary, and that's, I don't think of it, and this is my own little con, but I don't think of it as writing about sex. I think of it mostly as writing about heartbreak. It's just that oftentimes on the way to heartbreak, there's sex.
Right, which brings us to Wired for Life, one of the stories in the collection. It's about a young girl with a beautiful boyfriend who won't have the aforementioned sex with her. You write in the voice of women several times, including in this story. How does that feel to be immersed in that female voice?
For me, I get this question a lot. It's actually a great relief to write in the voice of a woman or with a woman as the protagonist because women live closer to their emotions, to make a big but true generalization, and they ask the sort of questions that the characters in my story are trying to tackle. Why did it go wrong? Was it something I did? Why has this person lost their desire for me? And I think that some men do that as well, but oftentimes when that sort of internal question comes up, they just click on SportsCenter. So in a certain way, it feels more naturally. I also spend most of my time with women. I just happen to do that. I find it more gratifying to be in the company of people who are willing to talk about that stuff.
Right. And I have said to you before, it must be tough to be a gal pal of yours because I would always feel as if you were trolling for material.
Well, it's interesting because I'm not one of those authors who says, I just dreamed it all up. You know, oftentimes my stories do come out of my experience or the experience of my friends who I care about and love. And the title story, you know, is based on an episode. Everything's been changed, names and so on and so forth. But it is based on an episode of, you know, a woman really getting conned by a cad.
That was B.B. Chow.
That was B.B. Chow, the eponymous B.B. Chow. And she read the story. I, of course, sent it to her, fearing that she would say, oh, my God, you know, you're a vampire. You've taken my life and made it public. But she actually very graciously said, oh, well, ow, it hurt to read it, but in a good way. Like, you seem to have empathized with what I was going through.
Which surviving the emotional turmoil brings us to the story, I Am As I Am. Here you're in the mindset of a little boy who, in just an accident playing baseball, well, killed another child with a baseball bat. There was just a story about this in the news, a child intentionally hitting another child. Mm-hmm. But this was just an accident, and you explore the aftermath on him. Would you read a little bit of I Am As I Am?
Sure. The pitch came in, one of Blake's half-hearted sliders, and Eric could see that it would not break. It would sit up and wait to be drilled. Eric's body would execute this and was already beginning to execute this, wrists and arms and trunk and legs acting in concert to pull the swing around, a single whipcord arc beginning over his left shoulder and ending as he stepped forward and felt his bat explode into Bill Bellamy's head.
Mm. That was stomach-turning to read that.
Yeah, stomach-turning to write it.
Why? So why did you go there?
The source of this story is very strange, and it's the kind of thing that it's this weird, ineffable process. When I try to think, well, why did I write such a thing? There are a number of things. One, I had a dream in which a little boy was receiving a cake that said, I am as I am. And that's one of the few times that I based a story on a dream, but it just was so haunting to me. The rest of it, I think, came from having hit my brother mistakenly, my mm-hmm. older brother, mm-hmm. with a baseball bat when I was a kid, and seeing his mouth bleed profusely and thinking, oh my God, I killed my brother. And I think in some ways the story is about how planned communities don't work and how you cannot, sometimes tragedies just occur. They are just accidents of fate. And the real tragedy is if children aren't allowed to experience their feelings about it. In this case, this kid is desperate to apologize, to somehow reckon with the fact that even mistakenly, he's caused this terrible loss in the life of another family. And because he isn't, his mother sort of tries to keep him away from it. It all builds up inside and explodes inside him.
Right. Steve Almond, his new collection of short stories is called The Evil B.B. Chow and Other Stories. And it, you know, especially in talking about that last story, it's an abrupt transition from your highly acclaimed last book, Candy Freak, which is now out in paperback and tells of your lifelong obsession with candy. Some of your readers of Candy Freak are going to be maybe taken aback by reading stories like I Am As I Am.
I suppose they might be, but I have to say a couple of stories in the book actually do have candy in them. And that's because, again, it's my little weird brain. So candy's always floating around in there.
And speaking of which, before we let you go, what's new? What do you find out there?
What's new in candy? A couple of things. One, almonds are the new peanuts, thank God, right? Mm-hmm. Product placement, almonds. And also dark chocolate. You will see the dark chocolate M&M. There's a dark chocolate Twix out there that's fabulous. I already bought a box of 36.
Oh, good.
Buy a box of them if you like them, because they're going to take them away very shortly. But that's the new thing, because there have been these reports of dark chocolate's good for your heart.
Here now, literary correspondent, candy connoisseur, and author of the new collection of short stories, The Evil B.B. Chow, Steve Almond. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our new cast producer, Matt Largy, and our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Freilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.